Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for joining me wherever you are. I hope all is well. Today something special, I think, something a little bit different. My guest is Dr. Meriting Tokwane. She's a prosthodontist, which means she makes dental prostheses. And she is also now currently sort of broadening that skill set, I suppose you could say. She's now doing a master's in maxillofacial prosthetics rehabilitation through King's College in London. And so we did talk at some length on just her journey into that and what it is her work entails. I have to say, over the last little over a year now, 14, 15 months, I've met some really incredible people, bright, amazing, sharp people through this podcast. And I have to say, Meriting was just a special chat, smart, driven, humble, great sense of humor. I think we had a great chat, and I hope you enjoy it. She's also a traditional healer. So we spoke a little bit about that journey, her path into that that way, if I can put it like that. Please now enjoy my chat with Meriting. So Meriting, good to see you. Thanks for making the time to see me, because I know you are very, very busy. As I was saying, I mean, I feel like I'm coming into this a little bit cold. I do try and do a little bit of research into the people that I chat to here, and you know, it's a fairly unstructured chat. But it was funny that, and I sort of mentioned this off air, that one of the only articles that I found that mentioned your name was actually an obituary for your father, who, in the Sowetan from many, many years ago. Mm. Was he quite a well-known character then? I mean, is your family quite
not in the limelight?
He just sounded like he'd made his own path then somehow.
I think he did. He was a very, well, I guess it's the environment in which he grew up in. So if you're a traffic police person, you know, people pay attention to you. They pay attention to you because you might stop them and give them a fine. But he was also a bit of a go-getter, you know.
Yes, because it mentioned then he ended up working for a computer company or something like that.
Oh, yes. But I don't know what it is. He was a messenger there.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay, I thought I had another image of him.
No. He was a messenger there. My dad was a typical Sowetan black male in that era.
50s, 60s, 70s.
He was born in the 40s.
Yeah.
And he grew up in Sophiatown, possibly in a gang. I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
He became a traffic officer. He worked for Patco. He was a driver, a bus driver. Married my mom, who's a nurse, a retired nurse now.
That is quite a
I've got
common
two siblings.
Thread there.
Yeah, it's very common.
The mother is a nurse.
Yeah. So
I suppose in those days it was one of the few paths available to some kind of
stability, I think.
Stability, mm-hmm. Aspiration, mm-hmm. And I suppose for kids as well, to try and better the lives of the children.
I think, yes. I think for my mother, who grew up an orphan, well, you know, not really an orphan, because her parents didn't get married. So her father moved to the States and got married there, and her mom died when she was in her teens, I think, early teens.
Okay. So, and the dad never returned then?
No.
Whoa.
So for my mother, she's always, you know, her plan in life was to make sure that her children had that stability.
Mm.
So yeah.
It's quite something, hey? Particularly under the pressures of the apartheid.
Yeah. Definitely.
To make that sort of normality out of abnormality, or if I can call
within,
it that.
Within that abnormality. Yeah. So, yes.
What were the sort of inspirations you got? I mean, you're an prosthodontist, is that
Prosthodontist, yes. So it's derived from the word prosthetics.
Yes.
And so I make prostheses for the head and neck area.
Yes. Yeah. So all parts of the head.
Yeah.
Jaw, nose, eyes, whatever.
Ears.
I mean, that is such an incredibly far out thing.
I know. I never.
I mean, what? How did that all?
How did it all
are you
come
a dent?
About?
Do you
I'm
have to
dentist.
Do dentistry?
Yes.
You studied dentistry.
Yes. So right. I studied dentistry, and the reason I studied dentistry was because I didn't want to do medicine. I didn't want to do medicine because...
Because I thought they were very... Didn't you have to do the first couple of years of medicine anyway? Was that?
Oh, yes. We were together until the fourth year.
Yeah, so?
So for me, the medicine part was... I thought I wanted a family. So, I mean, even at that young age, I thought I'll have more time to spend with my family if I'm a dentist. And I saw some programs on TV... And that's, you know, and I thought, yeah, this is what I'd like to do. But also before then, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a dentist. You must know, I think I found out when I was at school, in primary school, that there is such a thing as a dentist because we were asked, what is a tandarts?
Tandarts, yeah. Afrikaans word for yes. dentist.
So, like, we didn't know, but everybody knew what a predikant was.
Priest.
Yeah, because we all grew up under this
Christian. Within the church.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway, so I became curious to see, there's this thing. And it came up again later in my life where I saw this program and thought, this is what I actually want to do.
Jeepers.
I'd forgotten.
So what, in your teens then, before you finished school?
Before I finished school.
So you set your sights quite early then on this career in... Well, teeth-related.
Yeah,
kind of.
Well, I was curious.
Mean? I mean, the leap from dentistry then to this prosthodontistry
Prosthodontics is a speciality of dentistry.
Yeah.
One of the six. And, but before I get there, on my journey, when I was doing my undergraduate courses, you have to do a course in making false teeth. And that's called prosthodontics for undergraduate teaching or learning. And we were allocated to technicians to assist us. My technician was Terry McGowan, some Scottish man who I could hardly hear. But
he
spoke so fast in this accent.
Yeah.
But I sat right next to him. And we got talking, we got to know each other. And one day he said, come, let me show you what else I do. He took me upstairs to a lab. Something similar to the setting. But in there, I found noses, eyes, ears, faces, and that's when I got to know about this.
They're made out of what, metal,
made out
titanium?
Of
oh, wow, okay.
You know, you're talking about stuff that used to happen. It used to be made out of those things.
Right, okay, yeah. That's the sort of old technology.
Yeah.
When is this now? When are you sort of in your early years of university?
In the 90s, early 90s. So,
okay.
So that's how I got to know about this. But still, it was something far removed from my path. I just wanted to complete dentistry.
Mm.
Self-funded, you know, so it was not, specializing was not an option.
An option, really.
Yes. Then, and self-funding on bank loans.
Sure.
So already my options, my options are not that many. I need to pay the bank.
Mm.
But I went on to work. I did some private work at some point. And with the family growing, then I...
You had kids while you were studying?
I had the first one whilst I was studying.
Wow.
And the second one, I think, 2 years or 3 years after I qualified.
That is quite a balancing act, I imagine.
I don't know how I managed.
But you obviously are quite a sort of driven, energetic person. Or
I don't like problems. I'm just that person. I don't, and I admit, problems exist, but I don't like to dwell on problems. I mean, I think that's what gets me going, because I need to get to the other side of the problem.
You kind of focus on what's important then, and don't let yourself be distracted or cluttered by, like when I said to you about the address yesterday to get you, and you thought that was like
no
useless piece of information. Right?
Not now.
I'm gonna clutter my mind with that.
Oh God!
But that did give me a sense. I think yeah, but you're quite like my wife in that way. I think in a very kind of let's just rather do this. That's our focus and purpose right now.
For now, yes.
I'm completely the opposite. I'm kind of, my father used to say, I have a grasshopper mind. You know, just like all over the place. It does frustrate me, I must say.
Really?
But that's a
that's how that's you a are. You can't frustrate yourself.
Ah, jeepers! I know. This prosthodontistry then...
Okay, moving ahead. I think then I started working at Wurz on a part-time basis. I then got an opportunity as a full-time member of staff, and I started working in the restorative dentistry department, where you just do fillings and, you know, daily work.
Okay. Just working on teeth as opposed to the actual bones.
Well, not really, because even as a prosthodontist, I still work on teeth. But mainly, okay. it's you know, your everyday general dentistry is based on
drilling and filling.
I hate saying that because I don't want it to be like that. It shouldn't be like that if it's still like that. But it's about education. There are many opportunities now to do more than that. You know, preventative, diet, and so many other things that go with that. And just to show that this is part of the whole system.
Yes, exactly, yes. That your teeth are part of your body and can impact your health as much as anything else.
Yes.
This was something I found out only recently myself. I was, when I first moved back from Sweden working, did some work with Colgate and met, what was his name? He was the head of the dental... Dr. Rasmus, I think his name was. And he was just talking about, you know, the need for sort of basic understanding of the role of your teeth, and that, you know, just looking after your teeth is so important to your basic health.
Yes. I mean, they've gone as far as saying that dementia, you can reduce that. You know, the chewing, the impulses that are created or are sent to the brain during the chewing cycle. Impact or can decrease, so some people advocate chewing gum, you know.
Right.
So there are many things that and we're looking at less invasive approaches. So some of the diseases can be marked, can be seen or diagnosed from picking up markers from the mouth.
Right.
From the saliva, let's say, you know. So knowing which markers to look for. Those types of things. It's a very interesting approach or link to dentistry. And I think that's why I'm averse to just the drilling filling type of...
No, I didn't mean to sound flippant, but I mean, I have heard that is still very much the approach also, in many clinics.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Around the country, you know, just rather take the tooth out and be done with the problem rather than...
And create another one, and which although that's where I come in, because I will then give you another tooth, you know,
right.
So and make that prosthesis for you. Then I really needed to be challenged, and I asked to be moved to the department of prosthodontics, and the head of department then said to me, "That's fine, Meriting, you can move, however, on one condition." It's always conditions. I said, yes. He said, on condition, you work with Dr. Schmarman in the maxillofacial prosthetics clinic. It's a difficult clinic to work in because oftentimes those patients, they die, you know, because of their diseases. Because now that was a head and neck cancer clinic, really.
Oh, right.
And then I remembered Terry McGowan. I said, no, I'll do it.
Wow.
So I started working with a prosthodontist called Joseph Schmarman. And
Was this based at WITS then?
Based at WITS.
Right.
We interacted with the ENTs and the radiology department. And I got to see the picture, how big this whole thing was.
Hmm.
And I was loving it. I was growing in it. But I kept on having to teach registrars who came through that department and went to qualify and become prosthodontists. I was not becoming that prosthodontist, but I was training people who would then be
right.
at a higher level than...
So it was almost holding you back in a way?
I was holding me back.
Mm.
Okay, because I had an opportunity to train as well, to become that, whatever it is that I wanted to do. Now, I was passionate about this and realized that if I'm to be taken seriously, I must go and specialize and become a prosthodontist.
Right.
So I did that.
Hmm.
In 2009, I applied. I got in. It's a four-year contract.
Wow.
And, it's just it's a life-changing experience.
I can imagine, and I want to talk a little bit about it at some stage, the sort of technical side of it, but you are also, as you mentioned, you know, dealing with people with incredibly severe, life-threatening, deadly conditions.
Life-changing.
No. So there must be quite a strain on you then to... I mean, you have to be sort of strong, professional, empathetic, all of those things in the face of what I must imagine can be quite horrible. And how do you kind of maintain your strength and your direction in that context?
You know, Nick,
that's not too difficult a question.
I don't know.
Hmm.
Because I don't think about it. I don't see this as a difficult thing. I understand, and I mean, just yesterday, I had a gentleman who's going to have radiation for their cancer.
Hmm.
And we also do pre-radiation assessment from their mouth point of view, because if you don't, you may suffer from osteoradionecrosis, which is it's worse off because there's no treatment for it. He was asking me simple questions, which I couldn't answer because I don't have the answers for them.
Hmm.
And it's then that I get frustrated, and I always admit my limitations. I can only do so much. The rest, it's a team approach.
Hmm.
I usually do my bit at the very end.
So you're very sort of compartmentalized then in your approach.
Unfortunately, not necessarily. I always try and...
Well, I'm not saying that in a negative way, but it does help you then also work within a certain sort of context.
I should actually be doing that in a lot of cases. I saw one of the registrar yesterday. I was supervising the one directly responsible for the patient becoming impatient because there was somebody else that needed to be seen, and this man and I were just talking. But for me, that's part of the process.
Hmm.
That's part of the healing. That's part of the treatment.
Right.
Until this person can say, oh, okay, or let me go and think further about it, or come back with a question, you know, until they can say that, I can give them all the prostheses in the world. It's not going to work, I don't think.
Hmm.
You know, because it has to come right, and it's not my job. I'm not a psychologist, but there has to be something that says, I sort of get where we are, at least a part of it, because it's a long journey. And there are going to be other developments as things happen or unfold.
Hmm.
So maybe, yeah, you know, it starts at the very beginning when the surgeon, the ENT specialist or whoever, Maxfax surgeon, says, here's a patient. They've been diagnosed with A, B, and C. We're going to do a surgical resection. Can you provide us with a surgical obturator? And from that day on, until the patient stops coming, we are married to the patient.
Hmm.
The surgeon, on the other hand, will monitor the patient post radiation and whatever for up to 5 years and discharge the patient. What we give the patient is with the patient for life. And we've got limited materials to use, so after a period, they have to come back. We have to maintain those things.
Man, yeah, okay, I never thought about that.
You see, so if you give somebody a nose and they go into the sun, it's going to affect the coloring. And the margins are going to become, you know, affected. It's then every 2 years or so, it's a remake.
Sure.
And also that's a responsibility on us to then monitor any recurrences, if there are any.
Hmm.
You know, and when it comes to children then, children we have to...
They grow.
Yes, we have to anyway, because they're going to just grow.
Hmm.
So it's a marriage. Whether you are for it or against it, you get married. That's why it's important that you do not rush the patient into making a decision. And you always explain the benefits and the disadvantages, so that we know that just because I give you a nose, suddenly you're not going to develop a sense of smell, or you know, you're not going to start hearing because it just looks better.
Right. Okay. So you have to kind of give everyone the sort of full picture, as it were, in terms of the effect or non-effect of. So people think if they're getting a bone in their ear, it's going to improve their hearing, but it's more just a cosmetic fix, not an actual physical. That's somebody else's issue then, to fix the hearing.
Well, yeah.
If possible.
And sometimes it's like patients who have had accidents, losing an ear, you will still have hearing, but with the ear, it will enhance it because it will, you know, I don't know if you understand, there'll be... It will channel the noise better.
Right, yeah, yes. Of course, there would be some sort of just general follow-on impact anyway. Right. Did you always want to teach then? Because you're working now in the public service. You're a lecturer at WITS. You've sort of taken a very... specific path, if I could put it that way, away from the bright lights and trappings, I imagine, of a private practice. And I'm just wondering sort of what influenced that decision.
So I was in private practice I don't know how many years. I can't count, by the way. That's why I refused your numbers. So, I was out in private practice for about 7 years.
Okay. Oh, you did your time there.
And 5 years, actually, because I started in the public sector. I went into private practice, and I realized that this cannot be all that I'm going to be for the rest of time. This cannot be me. In the space, you know, doing only this. And I wanted to go back to school. But I really wanted to go back to school to do public health. And thinking that I can influence policy and make a difference at that level.
Right.
And so I applied to WITS as a sessional worker. I used to go there on... selected days for an amount of hours, and I realized that actually this teaching thing is not so bad, and I'm quite good at it. People come back and say, "Oh, okay, they can see," you know.
Yeah.
Once I explain, the student will say,
"The light comes on."
Yes.
So you get quite a lot of satisfaction out of that whole engagement, then.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
And even with my patients.
Hmm.
So when that opportunity came up to say, there's an opening, there's a post, I applied and got into teaching. And my teaching was at preclinical, so the very young or new students, before they go to the clinics, I started training, and I still do it today, you know, and the clinical aspect, but that's a smaller part of what I do. So I never thought myself a teacher, but I think what makes it easy for me to teach is because I remember what it was like for me, trying to learn and finding it difficult to understand certain concepts, and how I had to find a way to understand those. So I use all of those tricks, especially for those students who are struggling, and it works. And I'm finding more ways of explaining the same concepts so that nobody bothered to take the time for me.
Yeah, so you sort of reverse engineered the process in a way.
Yes. So I quite like that.
Yeah.
And I don't like, I mean, I love teaching, but I prefer those students who don't quite get it, who don't, you know, who struggle to see it, because I know from experience that you can see it. I was in the remedial group for prosthetics when I was an undergraduate student. So you know, I know.
Don't tell anyone.
Nah. I'm kidding. I tell my students all the time.
Yeah.
I said, and I'm a prosthodontist today.
Mm, yeah.
I can teach anybody. As long as they can hold a drill, a dental handpiece, I can teach them how to prepare a crown. That's quite difficult because you're only supposed to remove so much tooth structure and, you know. So
delicate, isn't it?
It is quite delicate.
I mean, it's a different experience when I'm sitting there and the guy's drilling away and it feels like he's about to go into my brain, but he's actually just touching it. When you rub your tongue over the massive hole, it's actually just a tiny hole.
Yeah, those tongues, the tongue, you know how.
It's crazy, man.
The tongue is not just a bad organ because of the lies it tells, even...
The way it feels things.
Even the way it feels
deceives,
things.
Deceives
very
you.
Deceptive.
Jeez,
this fact.
I'm going crazy, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to touch a little bit on technology now because I imagine, I mean, as you say, your first introduction to these prosthetics through the Scotsman, I forget his name now.
Terry McGowan.
Were made of silicone. Were those the sort of molds then that were then...
Yes, I'm not sure if it was silicone or acrylic.
Okay.
You know, I was looking, but I'm just talking about now. Silicone is the best we have.
Okay.
Yeah.
But all right.
But I know I went through a stage where we also still used acrylic. With Dr. Schwammann.
Okay. I thought it would have been like some sort of fancy metal that you used.
Do you know, the metal, the titanium frames and the chrome cobalt frames that we use are now becoming, it's becoming possible now. And I say it's becoming because of our resources. For some institutions using implants to retain the prosthesis is standard. I started doing a course with King's College this year. Actually.
In London?
Yeah.
Right.
And that's why I went to India. It was a face-to-face. So
I didn't realize you'd been to India. Tell me all about that.
What? Oh, I thought you knew why I couldn't see you before today.
Oh, no, I forgot. Maybe you mentioned that. I forgot.
So
when were you in India?
I was in India end of Feb, beginning of March. I came back in the second or third week.
All right. And that was through King's College. You were there.
Yes.
They have a project there.
Yes.
Aha.
And now the difference between this, what I'm doing now, and what in my prosthodontics MDent, is that I'm going to be able to see the whole process from saying hello to the patient, welcome, to the making and through the making, which was not part of my training because we've got people like Terry McGowan.
You've got the technician to do that. So you come up with the design and then they go and do it. Now you'll be doing all of that yourself.
Now, I don't know the law in South Africa in that regard. But what I know is that there are very few people in South Africa who can do that. There are a lot of dental technicians, but very few who can make facial prosthesis. And have an understanding, even for intraoral cases where there's a hole in the palate, you know, they don't, people need to, it's not just about engaging. It's about what structures are there. How will it function? Well, you know, will the patient be able to breathe, for instance? Do we have to make a hole, make it lighter, make, you know, all of those things. So that's why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because there is a gap. When the current gentleman I work with now, his name is Jamie Els. When he retires, that's it. There's somebody else. There are ocularists, a few in South Africa. But nobody else knows how to make these things, I think, properly.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamie also went through the same course that I'm doing way back.
God, man.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that it's an opportunity to teach again.
Right.
And to teach the technicians.
Upskill.
Yes. I'm hoping that I'll be able to do that. Because even to keep it to myself is not... And I can't do everything, basically.
Mm.
But there are times when I can do, if I don't have that support.
What are the kinds of things you're interested in or engaged with when it comes to public policy? You said that that was one of the reasons why you've sort of chosen this sort of public sector academia path. I mean, what obviously within a, are you talking about sort of public health from a purely dental point of view, or are you talking about sort of public health at a community level and people's access to resources and good care?
Do you know, when I was thinking that, I was really thinking from a selfish point of this whole thing. It was about what it is that I can still do when I'm 65 instead of sitting in a chair drilling. But I always like to be able to make an impact on policy and how they make decisions. For me, it's the dental aspect of it.
Right.
When I was thinking about it.
Mm.
Not so long ago, I think 2016, we tried to go and engage with, I don't know what office she holds, but oral health, HOD or something.
Somebody in a ministry, yeah, some kind of thing.
To try and make them understand why they should, for this particular clinic, which is maxillofacial prosthetics, why they should be funding us differently instead of funding us as a whole with dentistry. And I mean, we're seeing trends. It's never conclusive. Nobody writes an article and says there's conclusive evidence. There's always a chance that it's not. But last year, I presented a poster at the IADR just showing what we go through adverts. The number of people who are coming in with cancer of the eye, squamous cell carcinoma of the eye, with holes, which we need to make eyes for, is increasing. And when you look at their general health, most of them are HIV positive, especially those who cannot account for trauma or an underlying disease like diabetes. They've got, they're on ARVs, and it's the same pathogenesis, the same story. And we are saying there is a link. We see it anyway. Can we get that support? You know, and that's an example. I'm giving an example of the orbital prosthesis because we were just inundated. But you're seeing younger patients. And by younger, I'm talking about mid-20s. From the mid-20s up to our age group. I won't say what that is. Maybe 40s. So there is that little, I think, whether it's a coincidence.
Some kind of trend.
But there's a trend. There is a trend. So that's how I would like to influence policy. I'd like them to make them aware that money that you're saying is for HIV and AIDS, to try and curb that or help people live better, shouldn't end on ARVs only. It shouldn't go to research only. There are people who are living well, but they need extra help. They need prosthesis to go and interact with the world. Mm. Otherwise, they become very reclusive and depressed and then you wonder why there's mental health. You know, the impact is so great. It's just a vicious circle.
Exponentially.
Yeah. Sort of. So influencing policy. I don't want it to remove me from the clinical part of it. And you can't have both.
Hmm.
So I chose my passion, which is being in the forefront and working with the patients.
Hmm. Yeah, that's quite something, I must say. Quite admirable. You mentioned, or I should mention, and I want to ask you about the fact that you are a traditional healer. Is that the right term? What is the terminology that I should?
I think that's fine. I'm okay with that. Mm. It's
A traditional healer. Can you just sort of explain to me what that means then?
Do you know, for me, my experience with this is that I have for me, it was a spiritual acknowledgement. A part of me that I didn't even know or hadn't acknowledged or didn't know existed. And it took me being very ill for many years to realize that this is what I needed to do. And I'm a different person when you see me now. I changed. I didn't look like this. And, you know, it's difficult to explain the process, but I had to go and I don't know how else, there's no English word that I know, but to go through the process of ugutwasa.
Some kind of apprenticeship?
Yeah.
Ugutwasa.
Yeah, so it's a journey of self-realization and getting in touch with who you really are, what you know, your spirituality, what guides you, your ancestry, you know. Yeah.
Do you do this guided by a sangoma?
Yes.
Yes. So it's a sort of guided path that you're going on. And you mentioned that you went to a Catholic school. So obviously you felt that, you know, Western sort of religion, as it were, was not giving you the support or the guidance or the strength that you felt you needed at that time, and that's why you turned to this? Or
how do you
balance the two then?
No, I went to a Catholic school because, like you said earlier on, the stability, you know, the reason my mom was a nurse and then the Catholic schools were more stable and,
right,
yeah.
Better.
Yeah. So that was in Soweto.
Okay, it wasn't
religious component is that we were Catholic
there,
at home.
Yeah,
yeah. So we went to that school. And actually from that school, after spending years with the nuns, learning the rosary, I was in the Legion of Mary.
Wow.
At some point I thought I was going to become a nun.
Wow.
That was a plan.
That is something.
So,
no disco dancing then.
I didn't even think about that. I was so young. I was not in high school yet.
Mm, okay. Oh, wow.
So I got a bursary whilst at that school. That's when I went to a private school. And not just a private school, I went to Woodmead School. I don't know if you know anything about Woodmead School.
So, it's a very famous school.
So there was, I mean, it was the exact opposite.
Mm, very progressive.
There was no school uniform. There was really, you had to look after you and develop yourself and learn. And, you know, you were just given those guidelines to say integrity, respect, whatever. That's what you must live by. And so I went from wanting to become a nun to being a party animal.
Hmm.
And I think it was also the timing, because the stage in my life was that I needed to become an adolescent.
Express yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after Woodmead, My view of things were not that straightforward anymore.
Right.
And although socialized in a very certain way, that never goes away. When you're brought up in a household where You know, as much as they treated us the same, my brother and I are 3 years apart. There were times, and as we grew older, the treatment changed, you know. Hmm. And I became very rebellious to say, why doesn't he get to do that? Why must I do this? And because I didn't understand. And I think in their heads, they wanted to treat us the same. But the way they knew things and how to do things, there was a way for a girl and child a and for a boy child.
Yeah.
Going to fast forwarding, I mean, I've always been, you know, I'm a dreamer. I see things in my dreams. It's for me, it's just normal because that's how I grew up. Mm. I just thought everybody else has those dreams. I didn't think it was anything special. So, you know, it's just later on in life, these dreams became more intense and more clearer. This is what you must go and do, you know.
Wow, so they're almost like messages?
Yes, this is what you must go and do, and this is what you will look like. So I see myself after the fact, and this is what is going to happen.
Whoa.
So, and I just, you know, this is not what I plan to do. So hang on, I want to just do this. And I just started falling ill. I was in and out of hospital almost on a monthly basis. Had these headaches, these migraines. As
how long ago is this?
This was... Well, I eventually went to start my training in 2005.
Okay.
So before then, after I qualified and between those, you know, it just got progressively worse. I was skin and bones. I was covered in stuff. My face was, I was covered in, what are those things? Pimples, I think.
Mm.
So I went on this journey. I didn't know where I was going.
Mm.
I went to a Catholic school. I went to a private school. I went to university, for Pete's sakes. I did chemistry experiments. So when you put this and this, this is what happens. I didn't know where I'm going, what's expected of me. These ancestors that are bothering me, where are they? Are they coming? Will I see them? And nobody can tell you, nobody can prepare you for what it is that is going to unfold. It's just a journey that you need to put two and two together. You'll get guidance, you'll get the herbs, the necessary herbs, you'll be told what to do sometimes, and you don't ask why. Now, I'm that person, I'll say, why? So I learned not to ask why. And just to accept, and it's in the acceptance that you start to see that make the differences, you know.
Yeah, you have to throw yourself into that and throw aside all of inhibitions or your sort of preconceptions or whatever.
Yes.
But, I mean, had you had sort of contact through any of your sort of family traditions with the role of the ancestors? I mean, was that sort of a part of your upbringing? I mean, because I mean, I have spoken to some people, of course, where it does seem to be quite a strong part of the family and tradition. But you've come to this from a sort of completely different position.
It wasn't actually. And I think it was deliberately not something that I was exposed to. Earlier on in my life, I lived with my grandmother. Well, we all did, all the cousins, in a way. I had a moment where we lived with our grandmother. And, you know, she treated me differently. And I think my aunts knew why. I think my parents knew why. But it was, we're just going to ignore it.
About.
Yeah.
Huh.
But my grandmother had gone through the same path. I didn't know that.
Okay.
I didn't know that at all.
What?
So when I was growing up...
And she never mentioned that?
No, not to me, not in that way.
Ah.
Because when we were growing up, you know, my grandmother was that person who would just be busy. She always had, we had the garden going, you know. I mean, that's her yard in Soweto.
Mm.
We had the garden, the trees, the fruit trees. She used to sell stuff, popcorn, sweets, whatever.
This is granny.
Yeah. She's very industrious, that woman.
Sounds like.
And we all had stuff to do. My job was to count the money.
Oh, she sort of assigned you tasks.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many. My granny had 8 children, I think. 7 girls, 1 boy, being my father, the last one.
Huh.
Yeah. So.
Lots of cousins.
Lots of cousins. Older cousins. I was the youngest, actually, in that group, and I had to count the money.
Jeepers.
So she moved to Rustenburg, where she had chickens and pigs, and we all went to live with her at some point, especially during the riots in 76, 77.
Yeah.
And everybody had chores. My older sisters would be cleaning, cooking. Hmm. The older brothers, they would tend to the chickens, clean the pigsty.
Hmm.
In the meantime, she would boil the eggs, put them on the tray. They must go and sell them on the buses from the mines after school. Pack sweets, they must sell at school.
Sure.
My job was to sit next to her. And just be.
Sounds like you got a very cushy position there.
So she would also, and there was on Saturdays, everybody knows what they need to do. And my older cousin brother, his job was to make tea. And I remember this one time, she said, "Miriting, come sit here." And I was sitting there next to her, and my cousin brought the tea. It comes on a tray, all laid out nicely.
Yeah.
And then she looked at him and says, "Are you mad? Where is Meriting's tea? Go back with the tray and make sure that there is tea for Meriting as well." And that's me, the youngest.
The youngest.
Yeah. And no queries, went back, made sure that there was tea for me as well. And I'm sitting there thinking, I also want to play with the other children. Why must I sit here? You know, she would sit there and smoke her snuff, and she would give me some to smoke. And I hated it. I mean, to a point that I cannot put it in my nose today.
Snuff.
Yeah. And you know, there were times when, especially before we moved to Rustenburg, whilst we were still in Soweto, that there'd be church. People would come and attend church, and my grandmother was in charge. She was, And people would get water. She would heal like that, you know.
So
but
you,
it didn't.
You was there was and but that was something special then,
yes,
that she was.
It didn't register. I didn't see that.
And your parents never sort of.
No, I just used to think, don't these people have homes?
A lot of people, yeah, yeah.
Why don't they go home?
Mm.
You know, it was just that irritation that, can we just be all of us? I mean, there's a lot of us already. Can we just, you know? So it carried on, even in Rustenburg, because there were quite a few of us living there. And we lived in a what's today? It's called a prefabricated, in a one room. Mm, all of us were living in that room, made out of corrugated.
Not quite a John Dolo, but sort of something.
No, this common.
Metal.
Yeah, this what you
hut.
See today. Not a hut. A shack.
Shack.
We call it a shack, but it was well built. It was big enough. We ate in it. We slept in it. We washed in it. We fought in it. We laughed in it. You know, homework, whatever.
Yeah.
But and there were these beds. You know those beds that you fold up. Nobody slept on the floor. That was the thing.
Just lined them all up.
Yeah, put them on the side during the day, and there are chairs that come out. I don't know how we meant. I really don't know, because I just saw things happening. And the floor was white. It was a white sail, very durable sail, which they scrubbed every weekend. I don't know why it had to be white. coal stove, no hell. But yeah, so it's only later on, now that we had to go, and before you go, to start the training, you go and tell, you know, your people, the ancestors, to say that this is what I'm going to be doing. So we went to the graveyard. We did a little ritual, a job at home. And then I got to know about my mother's family from her dad's side. And they also had traditional healers. And so, you know, it was a whole lot of things that now I didn't know existed in my life. Despite having grown up in it, I didn't realize what it meant. I just thought, ah, this woman is eccentric and she's just weird, you know. And she hates Christians because when people come with Bibles on Sundays to preach, she says, get out, I'm busy, I'm cooking for my children, go and cook for your children, you know. So,
okay.
So, yeah. So there must have, there was a link. But
And how do you then practice that today? You know, I mean, do you help other people or do you use it just for yourself?
I don't believe that I can only use it for myself. I believe that for every interaction that I have with whomever there is help or some kind of
exchange
you know, and I believe that I do that for my patients. I believe that I do that for my colleagues. I have solutions to problems, but I won't know. I'll only know when you've told me the problem. I say, oh man, no, that's easy, just do this. One of my trainees who came after me said to me, you know, Gogo, you heal by consultation. It says by talking to people, you provide them with healing. And just this morning, my colleague said to me, you know, I wish God can bless you. I said, where the hell did that come from? Am I dying? What's? And she said, no, I've just realized that you're one person, you do so much for everybody, and you don't get a lot of recognition. And I said, or rewards, or something like that, you know? And I said, you know what? I do, actually. You just don't know how I get rewarded. Maybe I don't get rewarded with money. Directly, but I just feel so fulfilled if I can do that, if I can help somebody, if I give somebody a tooth, one, and they go, oh, thank you, I've changed somebody's life. Can having somebody else's happiness make me happy? And is that enough? For me, it's enough because it energizes me. It gives me the strength to just keep doing and doing.
Sure.
Yeah. So
that's beautiful.
That's really, and I must just say this, that, you know, through that journey, through those 3 a.m. mornings where I had to, you have a routine. It was physically difficult to begin with at the beginning. It was just painful. But at the end of it, at the end of having to throw myself on the ground to greet people, anybody, even children, it was, I found so much peace for myself. I don't worry about trivial things. That's why I'm saying I can see beyond them. When I see a problem, I'll recognize it as such. And I'll say, okay, so what now? It doesn't happen at the same time always, but just this morning I got an answer to a problem I've been worrying about or thinking about since last week, and I've got the answer. And I said, oh, okay. You know, and it seems like a small thing, but I think that's what people want. When people come to you, they want a solution. There are people who will go and take you to the river and cleanse you. Whichever way that you get that solution, I'm happy for you to get that solution. But also, I make it very clear that there's no magic. There's no magic. It is your belief. It is what, how much you want it. You have to be a part, wholly so, a part of what you do. Otherwise, it's, and I always say, it's like when in the Bible they say, Jesus said, Zamaya tumelo ya hao eo 40 seeds. Directly translated, go, your faith has healed you. That's all that it was. Mm-hmm. And that's all that it still is. You know, Jesus is no different. He was so in touch with who he was. And he knew how to use that energy. I'll call it energy. You know, maybe I'm simplifying it a lot.
No, that makes beautiful sense. So now what's next for you?
I'm taking over the world. Look, I'm doing this course with Kings. I'd like to open a rehabilitation center. I think it's gravely needed.
How long is the course now?
It's three years.
This is your PhD?
No.
Oh.
Still not a PhD yet. It's a master's.
Wow, okay.
It takes 3 years. It's distance learning. And in our clinic right now at VETS, at the Johannesburg Hospital, we see patients from all over South Africa. We see patients from Zimbabwe, as far as Nigeria. So there is a huge need. There's an increase in trauma, traumatic injury, assault. We know how we are. We know how motor vehicle accidents are. We've got this disease. We've got HIV and AIDS. And the disease patterns have changed. I think that's why they tend to be so aggressive. So my plan is to not have a standard dental practice. I'd like to do something that can cater for patients with head and neck disfigurement or defects, whatever it is that they present with, whether it's from trauma, from cancer, or they were born like that. To have a center that has all the disciplines that are necessary in looking after these patients. It goes from the dietitian all the way up to the, if necessary, we'll consult maybe a neurologist, you know, because some of them go into the brain, the diseases, but we need psychologists. So that's
full
my vision.
Full spectrum care center.
For that kind of disability.
Right.
Okay. I'll have an oral hygienist. I'm not leaving anybody out. I'd like to make it, if possible, a place where a business or an NGO that's run by females. Because I think there's more compassion. It's never rushed. It's never about let's do this. And there's always that added care that you get. And there are enough females in all of those fields to do that.
Yeah.
Especially from my background as dentistry. Dentistry has always been a male-dominated sector. Even now, when you look at those conferences, the speakers, so it's all still, and the young males are pulled up over your head,
yeah.
You know. So.
And that's a sort of global phenomenon. Then
it is. It is.
Mm.
In 2014, 2013. I was asked to be part of a group of females from all over the world to write a book. So I contributed a chapter. It's simply titled Aesthetics in Dentistry. You know, so you write, but the concept was that it was written by female dentists from all over the world, and saying what drives them. And it's headed by this lady in, she's a maxillofacial surgeon in, I think she's in Israel, Deborah. Only met her once in 2017 when they called us all together for a celebration of some sort. Yeah. So, you know, we need to also as females stand up and demand to be counted. Unless we do, there's always going to be this discrimination. I mean, I wear this, not because I'm married. It just gives me peace. It I get respect, and this came from my trip to India. The reason I'm wearing it, the reason I found it, I dug it out somewhere, was because I was going to India and we were advised to wear a ring to avoid that hassle. Unsolicited attention, because apparently it can be just too much to a point of being grabbed and, you know, harassed. Yeah. And
that's a sad indictment, isn't it, really?
So I'm
that's your protection. Like
this
your
is my protection,
bulletproof
yes.
vest.
So I wore it, and my travel was different from the normal. from Oua Tambo all the way.
Yeah.
It had it in India, I don't know what it could have been
just like.
Like
Moses parting the Red Sea.
Like people look at you and they back off and they say, oh, they respect you because you belong to somebody else.
Yes.
Sad. Yeah. So I realized that I was getting some attention that I didn't enjoy at work.
Mm.
And I wore it to work. I think this is the first week that I'm wearing it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
And this individual actually said to me, oh, so what's going on with you? I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, I see. I said, no, it's exactly that. It's exactly what you see. So I haven't had visits in my office. I haven't had phone calls. It works. And I was really trying to avoid the having to address it verbally.
Right.
Because it was going to be... besides the uncomfortable nature of the whole thing, I'm the one who's going to end up being pointed at as being
you're right. You
emotional.
Pay the price for that nonsense.
Yeah, and so yeah. I just thought, I don't need this.
Are you overreacting?
Exactly. Mm. And you're making assumptions. I'm a married man. What do you think I am, you know? Mm. So I thought, no.
That's a good trick.
Yeah. So when I see what I like, I just go... when I see what I don't like, I go like this. So yeah.
Oh, that's funny. We need to close now. Just wanted to touch... You have mentioned King's College, your travel to India, you've been on various conferences. Just sort of at that level, that peer exchange of information, exchange of knowledge, information, how important is that, attending these conferences, being in a global network of your professional peers in terms of your personal and professional development? And what are you getting from that? What are you giving to that?
So... when you're busy providing this care, everybody else around the world is doing the same, but not necessarily in the same way. So sometimes you can find a way to improve, or an adjunct, or whatever. So collaboration is important, education is important for ourselves and our patients. So it adds value like that. It adds value because at these conferences, you academically or at a personal level, I'm growing. I get to present papers. You get to write papers. So you meet the right people that you want to interact with, and you can go and exchange programs and see how you can better your conditions or your knowledge. There's always room to improve. I read something that everybody that you meet, no matter who, knows something that you don't know.
Hmm.
So
that's a good thing to know, yeah. Good thing to realize.
And yeah, to realize and so you give yourself a chance to grow.
Sure.
So I am getting a lot of exposure, but also a lot of
opportunities,
knowledge and guidance.
Yeah.
There's a gentleman who's quite well known, Professor Wolfert, qualified here at Wurz as well. Is now in Canada, has been for some time, but he's a big deal in this field. And he was guiding me in certain when I was looking at starting my PhD. So you get that input from everywhere else.
Mm.
And for me, that was a big deal. Mm. That he saw a talk that I gave as something worthy of that
response,
kind of
comment,
yes,
involvement.
Yes,
yeah,
yeah.
Brilliant. Eh?
So
it's affirmation. For
it's
you.
Affirmation that yeah. carry on, and
you're
I'm
on
doing
the right
I'm doing the right thing.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I think in academia, you know, there's very. My brother likes to say that, you know, if you look at the soccer players and the TV or actors or whatever, look at how much
celebrities.
They, yes, look at how much they earn, and what do they do for whom? So you don't get that monetary recognition, but in growing and going out and meeting and learning. That is what keeps you going. So, yeah. Mm. And in terms of technology and where you think, technology is already there. Mm. 3D printing is already there. Mm. It's expensive in terms, if you look at the initial outlay. But the expense is spared elsewhere. When you look at the time that it saves in theater, the risks that are associated with those long procedures, if it's well planned before, it's more
efficient.
Less time. Yeah,
yeah,
it's more efficient and less time spent.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And less risk then.
Less risk.
Mm.
So and the outcome is better. So
yeah.
Everybody is satisfied, the patient especially.
Yeah.
You know. So we started doing that because my ex-boss, who's now in Australia, had a practice in Morningside. And during my training, we did things like that for our head and neck cancer patients. It's getting more and more difficult. You know that the Department of Health was under administration not so long ago, I think 2 years ago, because of the monies, because of the corruption. It's affected everybody. So... You know, we need to just prioritize, refocus. Technology is not a luxury anymore. Like I said, the disease pattern has changed. If somebody loses half of their head, you need to engage other methods to help you plan. And they're looking at tissue engineering now. You know?
Sure.
So we're hoping
so
that
beyond
those things
the purely mechanical to the actual biological.
Yes.
Yeah.
So all of those things.
Sort of growing
are
skin and
growing organs and
yes.
So you know,
growing
they can
organs.
Grow. They can grow things, but how do they attach?
Transplant. Yeah, you're right.
You
right,
see,
right.
So
that's
now,
the tricky
so
part.
So that's where they've come unstuck.
Yes.
That because we're dynamic. I mean, we're amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know how we were constructed, but it's not going to be easy. It's not something that's going to happen soon, I think. You know, some people believe differently.
Yeah, we talk about the sort of man-machine kind of crossover, but it's not as simple as that.
Mm-mm.
No.
So sure. We are.
But you're in a dynamic phase then of your profession.
Oh, yes.
At sort of so many levels. Sounds brilliant.
Sounds scary, but I like scary. Keeps you going. It keeps you going.
Meriting, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
It's been just quite amazing talking to you, and all the best with your studies, and also, you know, I'll be following you now on this center that you have a dream of opening. It's I feel it's going to happen.
It has to. You know, when you think that, what's my purpose? What am I doing? For me, I have to do that.
All the best.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for having me.
That was, for me, a fascinating insight into a side of medicine, a field of medicine that I actually hadn't really considered and knew virtually nothing about before we had that chat. So I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you had as much fun as I did. You can hear the joy and the fulfillment Meriting gets from helping not only her patients but her students as well. just a sereneness, I suppose. And I thought that story about her journey, her path to becoming a traditional healer was also quite incredible. You know, the granny sitting with her granny, and you know, there's something that you know, there's a calling there. And I mean, I'm not a spiritual person by any stretch of the imagination, but there's that sort of pureness of her accepting that role or that path that somehow seems to be much, much bigger than her, and I suppose much bigger than all of us as well. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA on Apple Podcasts, Deezer, Radio Public, Spotify, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.